Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. If you've been watching our YouTube channel for a long time, you may recognize this case because we covered it in our very first episode of Criminally Listed. But a lot has happened in the case since then, so we wanted to do one final, all-encompassing episode about the case. But before we start, we want to tell you that we have our website up and running again. On the website, you can suggest cases for us to cover on Into the Killing, along with our two YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. Just go to criminallylisted.com and click on the Suggest a Case page. And now, for today's case, we're going back to January 1984. On New Year's Day 1984, Brunei became independent from the United Kingdom. The same day, New York City transit fare raised from 75 cents to 90 cents. At the time of this recording, it's $2.75. On January 2nd, Wilson Good was sworn in as Philadelphia's first black mayor. 2 days later, the sitcom, Night Court, debuted on NBC. The show ran for 9 seasons. On January 9th, rock band Van Halen released their album, 1984. The album featured the hits Jump and Panama and would go on to be the band's best-selling album. On January 10th, 1984, one of the most famous commercials of all time hit the airwaves. It was Wendy's Where's the Beef ad. It features three older women inspecting a burger from an unnamed competitor. They note how big the bun is, but notice that the beef patty is tiny. One of the women repeatedly asks, "Where's the beef?" The ad was an instant hit and became a cultural phenomenon. It spawned merchandise like t-shirts, frisbees, and even a board game. On January 16th, the top song in the United States was Owner of a Lonely Heart by the progressive rock band, Yes. The number one movie was James L. Brooks' classic, Terms of Endearment. Aurora is a city in the Denver metropolitan area. It is the third most populous city in Colorado. In 1984, it had a population of about 190,000 people. One interesting anecdote about the city is that in 1979, it was announced that it was going to be the home of a science fiction amusement park. The attractions would be built from the sets of the movie Lord of Light. The movie would be an adaptation of Roger Zelazny's 1967 novel Lord of Light. But due to legal problems, the movie never got made. A script was written and it was shelved. But the script was eventually used by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Canadian government. They renamed the film Argo. Pretending to be a film crew scouting an area to shoot Argo, the CIA managed to sneak 6 American diplomats out of Tehran, Iran during the Iran hostage crisis. It became known as the Canadian Caper, and the story was the basis for the 2012 Ben Affleck-directed movie, Argo. Aurora would later become infamous for a mass murder. On July 20, 2012, 24-year-old James Holmes walked into a movie theater during a midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises and opened fire into the audience with several firearms. 12 people were killed and 72 were injured. That terrible act of violence happened 24 years before another horrifying mass murder in Aurora. On January 15, 1988, the Bennett family had a small party. 27-year-old Bruce Bennett and his wife, 26-year-old Deborah, had 2 daughters, 7-year-old Melissa and 3-year-old Vanessa. The party was to celebrate Melissa's 8th birthday, which was happening later that week. Bruce and Deborah got married in the mid-1970s before Bruce enlisted in the Navy. Between 1976 and 1980, he was stationed at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. He worked as a sonar analyst. When he finished his service, they moved to Aurora. Bruce and Deborah started working at a family-owned furniture store. Bruce also attended college and trained to become an air traffic controller. In early 1984, he was hoping to get a job at the airport as an air traffic controller. The Bennetts lived on a peaceful cul-de-sac. They had just moved into their home a few months earlier. The family was considered quiet and average. They worked during the day and stayed home most nights. They weren't involved in any risky behavior and didn't have any enemies. They were the type of good-natured people you'd love to have as your neighbors. The morning after the party, Bruce and Deborah didn't show up for work. Their co-workers thought it was odd because they were very reliable. Phone calls to the family's home went unanswered. Bruce's mother, Constance Bennett, decided to drive over to their home to see if everything was okay. She got a bad feeling when she saw the garage door open and their car was still parked inside the garage. Constance got inside the house and saw things that no mother or grandmother should ever see. At the base of the staircase was the bloody, dead body of her 27-year-old son, Bruce. It was obvious he had died a brutal death. The walls of the stairwell were splattered and smeared with blood. Most people probably would have run out of the house after finding their son murdered. But Constance was a grandmother, so she had to check out the rest of the house to see if her grandchildren needed her. In the master bedroom, she found the dead body of Deborah, her 26-year-old daughter-in-law. It was clear she had died from wounds to the head. Next, Constance went into her granddaughter's bedroom. Tragically, Melissa, who was just a few days shy of turning 8, was also dead. She had been beaten in the face and the head. 3-year-old Vanessa was in bed. She had also been severely beaten in the head. Constance couldn't help but think who had bludgeoned 2 little girls. Then she noticed Vanessa was breathing. Constance raced to the phone and called 911. Vanessa was rushed to the hospital. Her condition was dire. Her jawbone had been crushed, and pieces of bone had entered her windpipe. She underwent hours of operations. She survived, but she was left with scars on her arms, face, and head. Vanessa was the sole survivor, but she couldn't provide any clues about what happened that night. She was just 3 years old, and she had been beaten in the head in bed. She may not have even awoken when her family was being killed, and then she was attacked while she was still sleeping. The police did their best to piece together what they thought happened based on forensic evidence. They think that the family was attacked sometime between midnight and 6 a.m. There were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. The police think that the killer entered the home through the unlocked garage door. Bruce either realized that someone was in his home, or he just happened to be awake and encountered the home invader. They started fighting on the stairs. It's believed that the killer brought a hammer with him. All the hammers in the Bennett's home were tested for blood, and it was determined that none of them were used in the attacks. Bruce was struck on the head 16 times. The killer then went into the kitchen and got a butcher knife. He then slit Bruce's throat. The intruder then went into the master bedroom where he raped Deborah. Once he was finished, he beat her to death with a hammer. He then went into the girl's bedroom. He did the same thing to Melissa as he did to her mother. He raped and beat her to death. Finally, once he was covered in the blood of her family, he struck Vanessa several times in the head with a hammer. Nothing was stolen from the house. Deborah's purse and the contents were found strewn about on the front lawn. So the police ruled out robbery as a motive. They also couldn't find anyone who would want to hurt the family. They weren't in debt to any organized crime syndicates, nor were they involved in any illegal activity. The police concluded that was a stranger-on-stranger sex crime. Anyone in Aurora could have been targeted that night, and the Bennett family just happened to be the unlucky family who was attacked. It's possible the killer watched the family's house earlier during the party and learned how many people lived there. But this was all speculation. The police put a lot of effort into solving the case. But at the time, without the help of forensic tools that we have today, like DNA and genetic genealogy, stranger-on-stranger crime were the hardest cases to solve. Unless there was a lucky break, like someone turning in the killer or the killer confessing, they were considered impossible to solve. The police thought their best hope for solving the crime would be terrible luck for someone else. If he committed another crime, he would hopefully get stopped or caught during the commission of it, or be spotted leaving the crime scene, or leave behind some better evidence. They also thought he had such a lust for violence that he wouldn't stop unless he got caught. Luckily for the residents of Aurora, he didn't attack anyone else in their city after the Bennetts. Unfortunately, he had attacked several people before the Bennetts. It appeared that attacking the Bennetts was his grand finale before he left town, where he was arrested for another crime, or he died. The first crime attributed to the Aurora Hammer Slayer happened on January 4th, 1984, 12 days before the Bennetts were killed. James and Kimberly Hobbinchild lived in Aurora. At about 2 a.m., a man entered their home through an unlocked garage door. He made his way into the bedroom where the couple was sleeping. He attacked both with a hammer. James suffered a fractured skull and Kimberly sustained a concussion. They both survived. Nothing was stolen from their home. 28-year-old Donna Dixon was a flight attendant who lived in Aurora. Later, on the same day the Hobbinchilds were attacked, Dixon arrived home. She parked her car in her garage. As Dixon was getting out of her car, a man struck her on the left side of her head with a hammer. He tore her clothes off and raped her on the garage floor. He then smashed her head on the wheel well to try to finish her off. The man then rifled through her purse, took some cash, and ran away. Donna managed to get up and got into the house. She collapsed onto a bed. Her live-in boyfriend was an airline pilot. He returned home the next day. He found her lying in bed and called 911. She was taken to the hospital and was in a coma. Donna ultimately survived the brutal assault. But it took a long time for her to recover. She spent months just learning how to speak again. Lakewood is another city in the Denver metro area. It's about 50 miles west of downtown Aurora. Patricia Smith lived there with her daughter, Cheryl, and her two grandchildren. She worked as an interior designer. On January 10th, Patricia worked in the morning, and then she was supposed to pick up Cheryl at a park and ride that afternoon. But she did not show up to pick up Cheryl. Cheryl called her cousin, and her cousin picked her up. Then they went and picked up her children. When they arrived home, Cheryl noticed something odd. The garage door was open, and her mother's car was parked inside the garage. Cheryl's children entered the house first. One of them found Patricia's dead body a few feet from the front door. There was a pool of blood around her head. A Winnie the Pooh comforter was covering her head. She was partially nude. Patricia's body had been posed to make it look like she was in a coffin with her arms crossed over her chest. The medical examiner determined that she had been raped. Patricia had been struck 17 times on the head with a hammer that was found next to her body. Based on the evidence, the police believe that she was killed between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. On her lunch break, Patricia went to a local fast food restaurant and purchased lunch. She then drove home to eat it. It's believed that while she was eating, the killer knocked on her front door. When Patricia answered the door, the killer immediately attacked her. 6 days after Patricia Smith was killed, the Bennetts were attacked. It was clear to the police that one person had committed all four attacks. The three murders and three attempted murders were all committed within 12 days of each other. In fact, the killer struck every 6 days. The Hobbin Childs were attacked on January 4th, and hours later, Donna Dixon was attacked. On January 10th, Patricia Smith was murdered. Finally, the Bennetts were attacked on the morning of January 16th. So the people of Aurora were worried that the killer would strike again on January 22nd. But that didn't happen. There were other similarities, like all the victims were attacked with a hammer. Everyone was attacked in their home. Twice he entered the home through the garage. In Donna Dixon's case, he attacked her in the garage. Finally, out of the six female victims, four of them were sexually assaulted. But unfortunately, not much evidence was found at the time that was considered useful. So the cases went cold. Life slowly improved for Donna Dixon. She married her boyfriend, Ron, on May 30th, 1984, just several months after the attack. She returned to work a year and 9 days after nearly being murdered. 3-year-old Vanessa had multiple operations and was released from the hospital after several months. She had a metal plate placed in her head, and the left side of her body had some paralysis. Her grandmother, Constance Bennett, was named her legal guardian. Vanessa had mental health issues growing up. Kids would tease her because of her scars. Or they made fun of her because her parents were murdered. She wouldn't get invited to things like slumber parties because children thought she would attract the hammer man. Understandably, Vanessa was an angry child who grew up to be an angry adult. She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar disorder. She eventually became addicted to drugs. In 2018, she was homeless and was living under a bridge. Constance Bennett was also scarred by the attack, even though she wasn't physically harmed. She said the images and things she saw that day are burned into her brain. There isn't a day that goes by that she doesn't think about what she saw. Then in 2017, her house burned down. In the investigation of the hammer attacks, over 500 people were questioned. In March 2001, a DNA profile of the killer was created from evidence left at the Bennett's home. It was entered into state and federal databases, but no match was found. In June 2002, a John Doe warrant was issued. A John Doe warrant is when the police know the person committed the crime and have his DNA, but they don't know his identity. 8 more years went by. Then, in 2010, DNA testing conclusively proved that the same man who killed the Bennetts also killed Patricia Smith. But still, no match to the DNA was found. In 2016, using the DNA, Parabon Nanolabs created composite images of what the killer might look like. But the images did not lead to an arrest. A break in the case finally came in 2018. It all started back in 2013 when the state of Nevada passed a bill nicknamed Brianna's Law. It was named after Brianna Dennison. In 2008, 19-year-old Dennison was raped and murdered by James Bela in Reno, Nevada. The law was that the police could collect DNA samples from convicted felons without a warrant. By the way the law was written, it was thought that DNA samples could only be taken from people who had been convicted of a felony after 1997. Then, in 2016, a judge made a ruling that clarified that any convicted felon could be forced to give a sample of their DNA to the authorities. On July 11, 2018, 34 years after the attacks, the police in Lakewood were told that the DNA belonged to a 57-year-old man named Alexander Christopher Ewing. Ewing was born in August 1960 in North Carolina. Ewing had been kicked out of school after the 11th grade. He said it was because he came to school intoxicated too often. As a juvenile, he was arrested in California for burglary. He spent 2 months in a juvenile detention center, and he was sent to live with a foster family for 2 weeks. After that, he became a drifter. He was arrested for petty crimes in California, Arizona, and Florida, but he never did any serious jail time. In July 1983, he was issued a Colorado driver's license. According to his license, he was living in Denver. In Denver, he worked in construction and plumbing. About 5 months after he got his Colorado driver's license, the Hammer attacks happened. Shortly after the Bennetts were killed, Ewing left Denver. He told people he was leaving because it was too cold. He said that he was heading to Las Vegas, Nevada. Instead, he ended up in Kingman, Arizona. Kingman is about 100 miles southwest of Las Vegas. 11 days after the Bennetts were attacked, it is believed that Ewing broke into the home of Roy Williams in Kingman. As Williams slept, Ewing threw a 25-pound piece of granite, the size of American football, into his face. Amazingly, Williams wasn't knocked unconscious. He called 911 and he was rushed to the hospital. He had to get over 100 stitches, but he survived. Hours after the attack, a police officer saw Ewing standing near an interstate on-ramp close to the crime scene. The officer was suspicious of Ewing, so he started questioning him. Ewing took off running, and the officer chased him. Ewing was found hiding under a bush, and he was arrested. The county jail was overcrowded, so Ewing was sent to a jail in St. George, Utah. 7 months later, on August 9, 1984, Ewing and 10 other inmates were being transferred to Kingman. In Henderson, Nevada, they stopped for a bathroom break. To use the washrooms, the inmates were unchained. When no one was looking, Ewing slipped away from the group. He ran into a Kmart and changed his clothes. He then ran from the store. The guards only realized that Ewing was missing when they loaded the rest of the inmates onto the bus. That night, Ewing broke into a house in Henderson. It was the home of 34-year-old Christopher Berry and his 24-year-old wife, Nancy. He attacked them with an axe handle as they were sleeping in bed. Christopher was knocked out early in the attack. Nancy tried to defend herself by putting up her arms to block the blows, but the strikes broke her wrists and bones in both arms. Nancy finally decided to play dead, and Ewing stopped attacking her. After he left, Nancy called 911. Nancy and Christopher Berry were taken to the hospital. Nancy survived her injuries. Christopher was in a coma for a week, but he ultimately survived. A manhunt was underway for Ewing, and he was arrested 2 days after he escaped. It was decided that the charges against Ewing in Arizona for the attack of Roy Williams would be dropped. Instead, he would just face charges in Nevada for the attack on the Berries. He went to trial for 2 counts of first-degree attempted murder in 1985. He was found guilty, and he was sentenced to 8 to 40 years in prison. He was eligible to apply for parole in 2021. But then, in July 2018, Alex Ewing was charged with 18 counts related to the Aurora Hammer attacks. Ewing was confronted and told his DNA was found at the Aurora crime scenes. He said it must have been a mistake. But the authorities said that there was no mistake. The odds that it was someone else's DNA is 1 in 230 quadrillion. It was decided that Ewing would only face charges regarding the murder of Patricia Smith and the attack on the Bennett family, and he wouldn't be charged with attacking the Hobbinchilds or Donna Dixon. They had DNA evidence in Bennett's and Smith's cases, and the district attorney thought that they would have a better chance of getting conviction in those cases. The trial for the murder of the three Bennetts began on July 26, 2018. The prosecution argued that Ewing's DNA, including his semen, placed him at the crime scene. The defense argued that the evidence was compromised because of the way it was collected and stored. They show crime scene photos of the police collecting evidence without gloves. They also pointed out that other evidence, like a strand of hair left on Melissa's pajamas, had gone missing. They argued that other evidence proving Ewing was innocent had gone missing. The trial lasted 2 weeks. Over 2 days, the jury deliberated for 9 hours. Ewing was found guilty on all counts. He was sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences. He then went to trial for the murder of Patricia Smith in October 2021. But a mistrial was declared shortly after it began so Ewing could get a competency evaluation. The retrial began on March 30, 2022. The defense pointed out that DNA evidence found on Smith's clothes, boots, and the hammer used to kill her did not belong to Ewing. They said that the semen found at the scene could be explained as a consensual sexual encounter. During the trial, Ewing complained to the judge that the system was rigged and he was being treated unfairly. He said that the police ignored evidence that led them to other people. The trial lasted about a week, then the jury deliberated for 4 hours. Alex Ewing was found guilty on all charges once again. He was given another life sentence, which was to be served consecutively with his other 3 life sentences. After 38 years, the case of the Aurora Hammer Slayer was finally closed. 61-year-old Alex Ewing is currently serving his sentence at the Colorado Territorial Correctional Facility in Canyon City. He does have a chance to apply for parole, but that will be in November 2097. If he happens to be a miracle of science and lives that long, he'll be 136 years old. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. As we mentioned in the intro, you can suggest cases that we could talk about on Criminally Listed, Paranormally Listed, and Into the Killing. To do that, go to criminallylisted.com and then go to the Suggest a Case page and fill out the questionnaire. But that's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.